and please help me welcome Steve L. from Nashville, Tennessee. Steve, go ahead. You can unmute yourself.
Thank you, Mickey. Good evening, everyone. I'm Steve Lee. I'm an alcoholic. I couldn't help but think, as Mickey was leading us in that set-aside prayer, she got to the part to help us see the truth, and I heard it helped me tell the truth, and so we'll see how I fare with that. And the fact is, I will be honest with you tonight, but I've discovered over the years that I'm often honestly mistaken, so I don't have the same commitment to accuracy that I do honesty, but if I'm in error, it will be an honest mistake. And I'm glad to be back visiting with you guys, I guess, both in person up there earlier this year in February, and then this is my, I guess, second visit for the STEP series. And this week I noticed that I'm following. You guys are teed up. You've been primed and ready with Jeff doing the first step and Katie doing the second step. And I listened to Bob's third step last night so I'd see where he left you. And he left you at the turning point, apparently, last night. That's where we are. That's what that third step is, right? It is this pivot in my recovery where I pivot away from the problem, having come to that concession in steps one and two, that concession in the first step that I can't solve my problem, and the concession in the second step that a power other than me will be required. The third step is my decision to seek that power, to seek the solution to the problem. And it's where you turn me away, because up until this point, both in my life in general and even in my recovery, and even today, I'll catch myself trying to solve my problem. I mean, it looks like the right thing to do. You know, it looks like that I'm going to identify this issue and I'm going to come at it with as much firm resolve and good intentions as I can muster, and I'm going to do better. But the third step is where you tell me, or the second step, frankly, is where you tell me I don't have the power to do that. The third step is where you redirect me away from my problem toward connecting with this power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. That's what I've said I'm going to have, right? Lack of power is my dilemma. I must find a power by which I can live, obviously, and it must be a power greater than myself. And so that's the journey, that the third step, that's the turning point. That's where I pivot away and change all of my efforts from this point onward are not about solving my problem. They are about connecting to a power greater than myself. And the fourth step is the real beginning of that, I believe, right? Because it tells me that's the mission I'm about to embark on. I'm about to face and be rid of those things in myself which are blocking me from the sunlight of the Spirit. So that's the mission on which I'm accepting and moving forward. You know, I hope to cover a few different things tonight, and I hope to do it. I hope to be efficient enough in doing so time wise to allow some time for questions or discussion afterwards. But I want to talk a little bit about why would I do this? Why would I embark on this fourth step? It doesn't look like it's going to, you know, coming upon it doesn't look like something that I'm going to enjoy or that's going to be in my best interest, particularly when I'm new. And I want to talk a little bit about what I expect to discover in the process of that inventory. And maybe even what's most important as I go about the process. And what I'm going to look at first in these areas of self-examination and maybe look at the directions a little bit. But I will tell you, I personally the directions are critical, but I don't want to lose sight of the spiritual aspect of the step, the undertones, the reason that I'm doing this. And because it doesn't matter how good my technique is, if I'm not surrendered to the process, if I don't recognize what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, at least that feels like my experience. And so why would a guy like me, come up on this fourth step and do this fearless and thorough moral inventory? And our book tells me that one of the reasons is because liquor's but a symptom. And I'm going to get down to causes and conditions. And the other encouragement I'm given, or warning, perhaps is even better, that it says a business which doesn't take any regular inventory usually goes broke. So in my personal life, if I'm not taking a regular inventory, I am liable to go spiritually broke. So there's an incentive to do this. Another reason is plain, that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. Well, I don't know about you, but that's not what I want to sign on for. So I don't want futility and unhappiness. So maybe that's a reason for me to go forward. And then it says, but with the alcoholic whose hope is the growth and maintenance of the spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely great. And so that poses in it a question. Is my hope the growth and maintenance of the spiritual condition? When I arrive at this inventory, is that what I want? Is that, again, the mission that I'm now on? To grow and maintain a spiritual condition. And if it is, then this is going to be a critical aspect, and resentment is life-threatening to a guy like me. So what are the types of things that I'm probably going to find as I go through here? And what am I looking for? It says it's an effort to discover the truth about myself. That's what I'm getting ready to look for. I'm going to search out the flaws in myself that caused my failure. So I arrive here a failure, and I'm going to look for the reasons. I'm going to do a forensic examination of my life to see what in me caused the failure. And then the book, as it gets ready to send me on this mission, it makes clear for me what the mission is again. It says, being convinced that self, manifested in various ways, is what has defeated us, we looked for its common manifestations. And that's what I'm getting ready to do. I'm getting ready to go into the resentments of my life, the fears in my life, the conduct, sexual and otherwise, in my life, and see where self has presented, has shown up in a way that has impacted all of those, that is at the root, not the root of some of the things that I will end up with in column two, but the root of my relationship to these resentments, my relationship to fear, my relationship to my behaviors and my conduct. So that's where I'm headed. You know, it's all through the book, and I'm sure what Bob talked about last week, and I heard him do a deep dive on that selfishness and self-centeredness being the root of my problem. It's the root. It at its core, my problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. And that blossoms all through those few pages, 60 through 63. We see so many references to self, right? We see selfishness, self-centeredness, self-pity, self-reliance, self-justification, that and 100 other words that I could put in that have the prefix of the word self in front of it. So these are all those 100 forms of self that show up. How is self showing up? How is self-pity impacting my resentments? How is self-reliance impacting my fears? How is self-justification impacting my behaviors and my relationships? That's what I'm going to take a look at. So right, we all know we'll walk through the process here and try to do it kind of quickly. And the thing is, I know that for the most part, I'm preaching to the choir here. Even the choir needs some choir practice sometimes. So we will, we'll look at it together a little bit. And so the first thing that I'm encouraged to do is write down, right? Put pen to paper. The 12 and 12 said, when I put pen to paper, that's the first tangible evidence that I'm engaged in my recovery. Everything else I've done up to this point, there's no evidence you could bring to court. You could only bring circumstantial evidence. But when I put pen to paper, you've got tangible evidence. There is physical proof that I'm engaged in this process. And with that, I begin to make this list of people of whom I'm resentful, of principles and perhaps institutions, all of which I might have these strong feelings against. And that's not hard for most of us. That's, at least it's a good start. I will tell you, I had a little trouble getting started with the resentment list when I got to AA because I didn't believe I fell into that category that the 12 and 12 talks about of the guy that didn't feel like he had resentment. Because I'm not a confrontational person. I wasn't an argumentative person. I wasn't a yeller or screamer. I'm a guy that just walked around quietly disappointed in the world and its people. All of my feelings were internal. I wasn't spending a lot of time expressing them externally. And so I just felt hurt, misunderstood, disappointed, frustrated, let down. And my sponsor said all of those can be synonyms for resentment. He says, put down anyone you're disappointed in, anyone that you feel is not understanding you correctly, anyone that makes you feel frustrated or uncomfortable. He said, take a look at that door over there and picture people walking in. And when you see that person walk in that door in your imagination, if you get a little catch, if you tighten up a little bit, if you get a feeling, maybe it's worth putting that person down. And maybe somebody like the IRS, maybe the medical community, maybe politics, maybe a particular channel on my television that represents a contrasting view to whatever my particular personal and political and social or religious beliefs might be or not be. Anywhere where you are finding yourself bumping into the world, maybe you want to put that on your list. And then I get to go into that second column. And the second column is really self-indulgent, right? The first column is I get to list all the SOBs I don't care for. The second column, I get to tell you why. I get to tell you what they've done or not done, how they've disappointed me, how they've hurt me, how they've let me down. And I've been doing that for years on a bar stool talking to the guy next to me. I've been listing people and talking about them most of my life before I get to AA. Now I get to put that down on paper. And then you say this third column that you guys all see the example in our book says now. Tell me what they did to you. Tell me what it did to you. Oh, it hurt your feelings. It got involved in your money. It injured your pride. It threatened your security. It impacted your personal relationships or your sexual relationships. This person's behavior, as you view it here in the second column, caused all of these feelings and all of these hardships in your life. And fear seems to be attached to most of those in one way or another in that third column for me. So now I've got to do this wonderful piece of work where I list people, places, institutions. I tell you what they did to me. I get to do that unfettered. The book says that when I do this, he calls it a grudge list. I mean, that's pretty cool. I got a grudge list and it says I'm burned up. And I get to come at this process while I'm still burned up. And so I've written this thing, who they are, what they did, what it did to me. And we can spend, you know, we could probably break up into discussion groups here and debate endlessly whether we're going to do a three-column inventory or a four-column inventory, or whether it's actually going to be, as Howard P. used to do, break down a three-column inventory that then expanded to seven columns by doing three columns on the fourth. We could beat this thing to death. And there's a myriad, what a great mistake to make is to navigate through variations of doing our inventory. But it's important for me that I get these things down in some form or fashion. And now I've got these three columns. And what am I encouraged to do next? First of all, once I get these three columns, the book tells me something that I think is critical. It says, nothing mattered but honesty and thoroughness. So that tells me whatever of these techniques I adopt, whatever approach I choose to take, none of that's going to matter if I'm not honest and if I'm not thorough. It doesn't matter how straight my lines are in my column. It doesn't matter how many of them there are. If I'm putting BS on the paper, then it doesn't matter what the technique is. But then I get to take, after that third column, I'm encouraged, it says, and I'm given a whole list of reasons in the book on the next page that talk about the reasons, and some of them I've already expressed, about why I probably need to go on. It talks about that life that includes deep resentment can hardly be a success, that it leads to futility and unhappiness. So I probably want to find some freedom from the feelings that are so stirred up when I look at those three columns. And the book says, what do I do now? Because it says I could no more be free of these resentments than I could alcohol. That's a pretty critical piece of information. It's telling me I've got no more power over my resentments than I do my relationship to alcohol. It's telling me that I'm going to have to invite a power into my life. I'm going to have to ask for power I don't have to do something I can't do. So it says, here's our course. Since you're stuck with these three columns, you're stuck with these resentments. You've got what they did stuck in your head. You can't get over it. So here's what you're going to do. Let's refer to our list again. And let's look at it from an entirely different angle. Now I'm grabbing that list and those three columns, and it says, let's look at it from an entirely different angle. And what angle is that? The angle, I believe, as I read through the rest of the book there, is that perhaps they, like ourselves, are spiritually sick. Maybe that's a new point of view for me to look at these resentments, at these institutions, even at these principles, but particularly the people. Perhaps they, not different than me, but they, like me, are spiritually sick. Here's one thing I would say, at least in my experience, it's true of me. I'll leave it to other people to decide whether it's true of them. But for the most part, men and women like us don't get to Alcoholics Anonymous without hurting some people along the way. We didn't always mean to do it, and sometimes we did. But we don't get here without doing a little bit of damage or a whole lot of damage. But my problem is I've always held the world to a higher standard than I hold myself. I give myself a pass often because I know I was trying to do better. I just wasn't very good at doing it. But so I've got these three columns. I'm going to look at it from an entirely different angle, that perhaps they're spiritually sick. And this is when I engage, as most of you know, now I'm going to invite God into this. I'm going to ask God for power I don't have to do something I can't do. And I ask God to help me show pity, patience, and tolerance that I would gladly grant a sick friend. Well, that's a tall order when I'm looking at column two over there. God, help me show pity, patience, and tolerance. God, help me not argue or retaliate. God, help me see how I can be helpful to this man. Everything about that is counterintuitive. Everything about that is contrary to what my character is encouraging me to do. But see, this is when we're going about the business of character repair, reparation. I've got a defective character. I know it is defective because it creates defects of character. And that is what I'm looking for in this inventory to see. So I've got to act contrary to how I feel. And I don't seem to be able to do that without God's help. So again, I'm asking God in to help me show pity, patience, tolerance. How can I be helpful? And then the book tells me the bare minimum I should get out of this. It says I can't be helpful to everyone, but at least God will show me how to take a kindly and tolerant view. So at a minimum, I hope that I can take a more kind and a more tolerant view. Now, the reason that's a good goal is because when we get to the 10th step, we will read in our book, if I am current with what I've done, that love and tolerance of others is now my code. So I'm taking actions that are continuing to put me in a position where love and tolerance can be my code, not just love and tolerance of the people that I choose. The book says love and tolerance of others. That sounds like everybody but me. Others isn't some others. It isn't a few others. It isn't others I agree with. It isn't others that treat me right. It's others. That is all others. So I'm asking God for this power I don't have, and I'm starting on this journey that's going to bring about this continued change through steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 that render me at the 10th step with love and tolerance as my code. And growing in understanding and effectiveness as my mission. All of this is to get me freer of me so I can move toward those things, so I can be of maximum service to God and my fellows. So anyway, now, right, so we started that prayer. What I'm encouraged to do and what I do is pray that prayer over the list of people. And I continue specifically with, in my case, typically the individuals that are on there rather than just a group prayer. I do it individually just because for me, that seems to have a little more power to it. That doesn't mean that that's true for others. It's just been my experience when I personalize it. I seem to connect better to the prayer and to the power. So, and that's where, through that prayer process, is where we begin, or I begin to be freer of the resentment. That's where the forgiveness begins, right? Because I'm, again, trying to get that kindly and tolerant view. Let me give you a definition of tolerance that was given me a number of years ago, because I always tended to view tolerance as like having a pain tolerance. And that's what it felt like there. I will tolerate you. And for me to tolerate you the way I have typically used it means I'll allow you to be as screwed up as you are, and I'll bite my tongue and not say it out loud, but I know how screwed up you are. And I'm not free of that, but I'm going to tolerate you. But I was given a description, and it comes from an old Reader's Digest from over 50 years ago, that describes tolerance as a bigness and generosity of spirit, allowing others their particular point of view and peculiarities. And see, I really like that language. I like the idea, you know, he's not an SOB, he's just peculiar. Now, I would rather view you as peculiar then give you the type of power that I tend to give people when I attach those types of other names to them. And so now that I've done this prayer work, the book takes me to the next step in this process. And it tells me, all right, let's look at the list again. Now we're going to pull out this damn list another time. And it says, this time, let's look at the list. And setting aside the wrongs of others completely, that's column 2. I get rid of column 2 completely. I get rid of column 3 completely. And I'm just looking at the names now. Setting aside the wrongs of others completely, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. See, it said before I started that prayer work, the book said that while we don't like their symptoms and the way they affect us, they like ourselves are sick too. The symptoms our column two, the symptoms are their behavior. That's the symptom of this spiritual illness. The way they behave, the way I behave. Column three is how they affect me. So now I've done this prayer work, and now I just get rid of those two columns. It's been fun. It's been nice to talk about them, but they are no longer germane to the process that I'm engaged in when I now look at this list for the third time. Because now it says I'm setting aside the wrongs of others completely. Now I'm resolutely going to look for my own mistakes. Where have I been selfish? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been resentful? Where have I acted out of fear? And I don't take that to mean necessarily in relationship to what I wrote in column two. But can I look at number one, can I look at the people on that list, and have I ever been dishonest with any of the people on that list? Have I ever acted out of fear in my relationship to any of the people on that list? Have I ever been resentful of the people on that list? Well, certainly I have. They wouldn't be on the list. All of these things, have I ever? And the truth is, I apply it first to the people on my list, but then I can go even broader. If not that person in particular, have I ever acted out of fear, out of resentment, out of dishonesty? And the truth is, of course I have. And I'm looking, I am moving on in this process, hoping for a fresh start, a new beginning, some forgiveness, some repaired relationships, to get back in the house, to get back in the big bag. I'm trying to repair relationships, and I'm hoping people are going to show some kindness and tolerance toward me. And with God's help, can I begin to offer that back to the people that I've had on this list, or to the institutions, and even the principals? And that's the process by which I think I go through this. And when I do, and when I do it earnestly and honestly, and when I sincerely invite God into that process, what happens is, at a minimum, the swelling begins to go down on these resentments. They might not disappear completely, immediately, but they begin to go down. They begin not to be quite so tender and inflamed. I begin to grow in effectiveness and understanding a little bit. So if I do that, let's move on to what the book sends me to next, because it talks about right after that, it says, boy, fear's certainly been involved in most of these relationships and resentments. And it says, we think fear ought to be coupled with stealing. You know, it causes so much damage. I love Bill's writing in there, right? He said it's an evil and corroding thread woven throughout the fabric of our existence. My goodness, that's a dramatic read right there. That's some good stuff. But that's the role fear has played. It is woven. It is connected. It is the tissue that is going all the way through me that seems to influence almost every relationship I have. Both personal and my relationship to money, my relationship to sex, my relationship to fear, my relationship to the world, and my relationship to God is impacted by a self-centered fear that I don't even recognize that I wasn't even using that name to call it by until I begin to see it in this inventory. Let me go back just a second to that resentment inventory to tell a story some of you've heard me tell. But it's a little bit like that inventory, and particularly those first three columns, are a little bit like an episode of CSI. And if any of you have ever watched any of the CSI shows, those procedurals, they all begin the same way, right? In the first scene, somewhere in that first scene, there's a dead body. And in this particular episode, a car has driven off of a bridge, fallen hundreds of feet down into a ravine where it hit and crashed and smashed and burst into flames. And in this car is a body that is mangled from the fall and burnt from the fire. And they call the CSI team, and to all external evidence, it looks like that either the fire or the fall killed this person. But that's not good enough for the CSI team. They take the body back to the lab and they do an autopsy. And in the autopsy, they cut, they go in. And when they go into that dead body, that badly burned and badly mangled body, they find that this man actually died of a massive heart attack, which caused the wreck, which caused the fall, which caused the fire. And that's what I'm doing in this inventory. Column two is the wreck and the fire. But when I do this spiritual autopsy, I discovered where self may have been engaged in some of these relationships. I get over there to fear, and it says when dealing with our fears, we put them on paper. Fear inventory, I think, is the simplest to do. It has been the most helpful to me over the years. It just says when dealing with our fears, we list them. We put them on paper. And then I ask, so I get this list of fears. And then I ask myself, why am I afraid? Why do I have them? And apparently, it's a rhetorical question because the book answers it for me. The book said, isn't it because self-reliance failed us? If I look at this list of fears, what is it I'm afraid of? You know, when I put down in my fear inventory, looks and sounds a lot like most of yours, so particularly over the years it has. Usually there's I had a fear of going broke, and I went broke, by the way. But was I afraid of being out of money, or was I afraid of what happens when you're out of money? Was I afraid of being on the street? No, I was afraid I was going to have to move out of this house into this house. I was afraid I was going to have to stop driving one car and drive another kind of car. I was afraid I was going to have to do some things I did not want to do or did not feel like I could handle. When it says that fear, that self-reliance fails me, here's what I believe self-reliance looks like on me. Self-reliance means that something's going to be T-O-O something. I'm going to be too old. Or too poor, or too lonely, or too embarrassed, or too tired, or too stupid. I'm going to be, and I'm going to be, T-O-O means it's more than I can handle. And when it's more than I can handle, like I won't be okay if this happens. And that's a fearful place for me to be. But the book says, well, but wait a minute. We think there's a better way than self-reliance. It even says self-reliance is good as far as it goes. It doesn't go far enough. So we think there's a better way. And that better way is trusting infinite God rather than our finite selves. It says we're living on a different basis. Just last night, you guys, if we are theoretically taking these steps that we're talking about, just last night, you changed the basis upon which you were living. Just last night, you turned your will and your life over to the care of God. Just last night, you said in that third step prayer, do with me as you will. But here's what happens to me. I mean it. I mean, I think I mean it when I say it. I'm not consciously not meaning it. But what happens is I say, do with me as you will, except I keep a list of things that I'm really not willing to let happen. Do with me as you will, except I want my wife to stay. Do with me as you will, except I need a certain amount of money. Do with me as you will, but I need my daughter to stay out of trouble. I need my daughter to act the way I need her to act. Do with me as you will. And, you know, I had a guy when I was about 3 years sober, and I'd been spouting off at a meeting, sanctimoniously, and the guy followed me out to my car, and he said, Steve, it is clear to me that you want to serve God. He said, it's too bad it's only in an advisory capacity. And I think that unfortunately I fall into that unknowingly because I am asleep. I am unconscious. I am unaware of the fact that I have this whole list of things that must happen and a whole list of things that cannot happen. And when that's happening, boy, I'm going to be afraid. I'll tell the story that many of you have heard me say, and then we'll move on to what you came here for, the sex inventory. But our friend Howard P. that passed away about a year and a half ago, and Howard used to tell a story about a man walking across a frozen lake. In fact, Howard wrote a book called My Life on a Frozen Lake. And many of you have heard Howard tell the story, and he certainly tells it better than I do, but I have co-opted Howard's story and changed it a little. In Howard's story, there's a man getting ready to walk across a frozen lake, and with each step, he's afraid that the ice is going to crack and he's going to fall through and drown. And what a tedious, angst-driven walk that must be, with each step to be afraid that the ice is going to crack. And the larger message being that I will tend to live my life that way, that I will go through life walking on, like I'm walking on ice that might crack any moment, with that type of fear and that type of anxiety. And I told Howard, I said, in my story, there are two men walking across the frozen lake. One man, afraid with every step that the ice is going to crack and he's going to fall and drown. And the other man, absolutely sure that the ice is going to hold him. And they take off on their walk together. And halfway across the lake, sure enough, the ice cracks and they both fall through and drown. But the guy who thought the ice was going to hold him had a much nicer walk up until then. And what I would tell you is I don't know whether the ice is going to crack or not. I don't know whether the things I'm afraid of will or will not happen. I just know that I don't want to live my life in fear with each step that that ice is going to crack. So I've decided to trust that infinite God. And I still fall back into that fear, obviously. But I have a different basis to live on, that third step where I've turned my will and my life over. What that means, I embrace the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. I take the actions that AA suggests I take rather than take actions based on how I feel or what I need or what I want. I become principle guided rather than feelings and thinking guided. And I do that in spite of the uncertainty that comes with that. But so far, 31 years later, I'm still here. And so that's the approach to fear. It says I simply ask God to remove my fear and turn my thoughts to what he would have me be. And there's a few places. One thing God would have me be is happy, joyous, and free. Another thing God would have me be is of maximum service to him and my fellows. One thing that God would ask of me, I believe, what I do is try not to assign my human characteristics to a higher power that isn't limited by those human characteristics. And say, I'm going to trust your direction. And so now I'm living a principle-driven life rather than a feelings- and thinking-driven life. That's the third step decision. Executing it is walking through these fears. The book says all men of faith have courage. Doesn't mean they're absent fear. It just means we've got courage. We're going to take the right action. I know we're going to run out of time, so I want to move on to the sex conduct inventory, but I will tell you, I've discovered about the sex conduct inventory. It takes longer to talk about it than to actually perform the act. But the other thing I want to say is that it really is the least talked about of the three areas of exploration, of self-exploration that we do. Yet, it is whenever I hear a fifth step, and someone has left something out of the fifth step and they come back later and say, Steve, I didn't tell you something. It is almost always of a sexual nature. The reason that it is such a we talk about it so seldom, at least in this type of setting, is because it's challenging. It's hard to find the right appropriate way to have the conversation and not turn into a room full of junior high school students. It's tough to bring the maturity level that's needed to have this conversation. But I know it's critical, and here's how I know it's critical. there's two or three important things that I'm told right away that comfort me when I get ready to look at this area of my life. The first is that the book says we all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. And it's important for me to at least own up. For me, the book doesn't say we used to have some sex problems. They write it in the present tense, and I read it in the present tense. It says we all have sex problems. Now, they look a little different on me today than they used to, but that can show up in a variety of different ways. The other thing that's comforting to me is the book says a little further down that we treat sex like we would any other problem. So the only thing that makes this feel so different is because it's so personal and private. And sometimes we attach shame or guilt around the behaviors. And here's the interesting thing. I'm certainly not going to talk about the behavior. The book doesn't care about my behavior. AA doesn't care about my behavior. AA says it doesn't want to be the arbiter of anyone's sexual behavior. All I am asked to do in this area of my life is subject it to some of the same questions I subject other areas of my life to. It says I subject to this area of my life, is it selfish? Who might get hurt? Am I being dishonest? What could I do instead? These are the questions. It's not about the behavior. It's about, is this getting in the way of my relationship with God, and is this getting in the way of my relationship with you? What I'm grateful for is when I had gone to my sponsor at 8 years sober with an issue in this area, he didn't tell me I was doing something, and he said, he said, well, Steve, he said, either quit doing it. I said, this is what I'm doing, Frank, and I feel kind of guilty about it. And he said, well, either quit doing it or quit feeling guilty. I don't care which. He said, but since you feel guilty, why don't we do an inventory? And he said, as a result of the inventory, you will either discover what does not work for you about this behavior, or you might find yourself free to engage in this behavior without the guilt. See, he was uninterested. I'm sure he had an opinion, but he wasn't giving me his opinion. What he was doing, he said, let's let the inventory take us where it takes us. Let's just honestly ask these questions to ourselves. You know, the book says we want to be careful, right? It says that we avoid extreme opinions. Here are some of the extreme opinions that are in the book, and I suggest we could find on the screen if we took a poll. Some of the extreme opinions are that some voices say sex is the lust of our lower nature. Some say that sex is the base necessity of procreation. Some bewail the institution of marriage. Some think most of the troubles of the races are traceable to sex. Some think we don't have enough of it. Some think it's not the right kind. Some would allow a man no flavor for his fare, and some would put us all on a straight pepper diet. In other words, there's a whole scope of opinions, approaches, points of view. And AA says we're not worried about those. We're not going to get into picking those apart. What I'm going to ask you is to ask yourself, in each case, is it selfish? Who might get hurt? If there's another person involved, are there even more people involved? Often the other person, my co-conspirator, if you will, in an interlude, might have other family members, might have kids, might have a husband, might have other family members. There can be any number of ripple effects of my behavior that I never even took a look at. Who might get hurt? Is it selfish? What can I do instead? And then I'm given some pretty solid direction on what to do about this. Because it says the right answers will come if I want it, right? It says what I want to do is form a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life. And by the way, I would tell you here that, for those of us, I often remove the word sex. I certainly do the sex conduct inventory, but I can also, apply that to a business relationship, to an AA relationship, to a social relationship. It is about my relationship to things. And so I can plug in different things and review it and examine, do a self-examination around these different areas of my life. And I want to find a sane and sound ideal. And it says, I must be willing. So I ask God. The way I do that is ask God. So now I'm inviting God back into this, right? I'm asking again for power I don't have to do something I can't do. I'm asking God to help me form a sane and sound idea. It says, I must be willing to grow towards it. So am I really willing to move in the right direction? If I've identified this, am I willing to, which is kind of a six and seven thing. Am I truly willing to have ask God to take this defect, whatever it might be? And the behavior is not the defect. I don't want you to misunderstand. I often will consider the behavior as the defect. The behavior is the outgrowth of the defect. The behavior is the fruit of the tree. Self-centered fear is the root of the problem. And that's ultimately what I'm getting to. So I ask God to help me form a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life. I will tell you in the 12th step, back in the 12 and 12, it talks about the fact that there will come a time that every sound human being, so maybe this is what a sound sex life looks like or relationship looks like. It says there'll come a time that every sound human being will want to have the deepest possible union with someone in the areas of physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional. I was married a long time before I gave thoughtful consideration to the spiritual, mental, and emotional relationship with my wife. I mean, I didn't know I wasn't. I just wasn't. I wasn't mindful. I wasn't aware. I wasn't awakened. We all, you know, when it says when boy meets girl on AA campus, trouble arises. And it says that they want to be well enough established. That's both in their recovery and with each other. They want to be well enough established that in the areas of spiritual, mental, and emotional, they're compatible and it's not wishful thinking. It's funny to me that there it doesn't mention physical. Over previously, physical was in the top four. Now it just says spiritual, mental, and emotional, because when boy meets girl on AA campus, the physical happens like that. That we're going to get physical and we'll figure this other stuff out later. You know, let's go quick. Let's do this. And I'm pretty sure I'll get along with you spiritually, mentally, and emotionally. And this is encouraging me now to look at this person in a completely different way, as a fully formed human being, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, and physically. Because the physical part of a relationship can be a very important, satisfying, appropriate, God-given part of a relationship. So I don't want to ever diminish the role that is. It remains important to me today. But I want to have things all in their proper perspective. And again, so it says that if sex is all the more troublesome, that we throw ourselves all the more into working with others. Like everything we do, every step we get to here, when we get toward the end of the step, it says pray and help somebody. Pray and help somebody. And that will quiet the imperious urge. Boy, I was driven by some urges. I didn't know they were imperious, but now I know that fits pretty good. The imperious urge. I mean, that's some colorful writing. I love this stuff, man. And I never say, hey, boys, I've got an imperious urge. Let's hit the club tonight. No, it was just her. I didn't go through the personal ads because I had an imperious urge. I didn't go on the porn site because I had an imperious urge. I didn't know what was going on. So we're just encouraged like every other aspect of our life. And here's, at the end of the day, here's the good news and what I'll close with around this part of the inventory. When it's all said and done, it says God alone can judge our sex life. That's between me and God. I'm not trying to please you. I'm not trying to please anybody else. If I can be honest enough to ask and answer those questions, I will arrive at a sane and sound ideal that works for me that might look different than what works for you. So the information, the behavior is less important than understanding my relationship. And is this getting in the way of my relationship with God and getting in the way of my relationship with my fellow man? Because if it's blocking one, it's blocking the other. When I'm done with that inventory, when I've got those three areas of examination, the book says that if I've been thorough, I will have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about myself. And that's often one of the first things that I ask somebody when we get together on a fifth step was before we run too far, tell me, what did you learn about yourself you did not know when you started this inventory? Because usually there's some things I go in and I go, oh, I know that's bad behavior, and I know I want to get past this resentment. And there's some things I think I know going in, but I am almost always surprised at some nuggets that I discover by giving myself over to the process that I had no idea of when I started. When I did an inventory a few years ago, I my sponsor died and I got a new sponsor and we went through the steps together, and I was 20 years sober. I was 19 years sober at the time. And when I got done with that inventory, the big chunk of truth about me was I had discovered pride was the primary defect of character that was influencing all three areas of investigation. Pride was the primary source of my resentment. Pride was the primary source of the fears I took into that inventory. And pride was the primary source of how sex was playing a role, whether it was by behavior or in my head, the role that sex was playing in my life. And I told my sponsor, I said, I'm really surprised that pride is what I've discovered. And he said, well, Steve, he said, pride can't spot pride. He said, you can't see pride through prideful eyes. And he said, I imagine if you had asked around a little bit, other people weren't having near the problem spotting your pride as you were. And I did ask around, and he was right. It was pretty evident to a lot of people close to. But anyway, that's where we land, and now we've got this newfound information with ourselves. We leave there not always feeling better in the fourth step, but I leave that fourth step headed to that fifth step that you'll hear about from Billy tomorrow night. Thank God he'll clean up the mess I left behind here. And we take this stuff into that fifth step. And I've got more information about me than I have ever had. And boy, it requires a little bit of humility to share those big chunks of truth about myself. I hope some of this was useful and coherent. It's been fun to hang out with you. Ralph, thanks for inviting me. Mickey, thanks for chairing the meeting.
Thank you so much, Steve. And you'd never leave a mess behind. You clean up my mess that's in between these 2 years. Listening to you helps me clean up my mess. And that exceptionalist, I forgot about that until you mentioned it, because I can revert right back to that exceptionalist, especially like if it's somebody that I love and care about, like say they're just going to have a surgery or something. Mm-hmm. I always want to pray for his outcome, but I forget it's his outcome, not mine. I still pray wrong a little bit and stuff. And we were talking about the sick man's prayer right before the meeting. And somebody told me if I didn't have time to do that sick man's prayer all the way out, just say, bless them, change me. Real short version. And that helps a lot. Because if I do everything with love and forgiveness, I'm normally working towards my God's will. But it's 8 o'clock. I'm going to open up for the question and answer portion of the meeting from comments in the chat section, which will be read in the order they come in. Or you can raise your hand located in the participant section to share. And the chat is now open. So you guys can use the chat also, and the meeting is open. Thank you again, Steve.
I'll ask, since everyone's shy. My name is Ralph. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Could you expand, since there's a lot of new people on here, about self-reliance failing us to some of the new people? I think that a lot of people get caught up with that.
Say it again, Ralph. I'm sorry.
There's a lot of new people on here. Could you expand a little on how self-reliance fails us? Because I got a lot of people that are writing that somehow get stuck there, but you explain it really good.
Well, on me and you know, that self-reliance, we went all through in the book, like I said, in the preceding pages leading up to this, talking about all those manifestations of self. And like I said, and we can all add to it. But it includes self-pity, self-righteousness, all these forms of self. In the third step prayer, I ask at least to relieve me of the bondage of self. And self, as I view it in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the pride and ego. It is the egocentric part. And I'm trying to make a shift from being self-centered, mind-centered, to being God-centered and God-directed. And so the truth is I come through here recognizing that while I might show some bravado or was a guy that maybe looked confident on the outside, I was constantly afraid. Mostly what I was afraid of is what you were going to think about me. You know, people, I hear a lot of people in AA show up and sometimes say that they were perfectionists. And I don't argue with anybody else's point of view, but I would have told you I was a perfectionist when I got to AA, but nothing could be further from the truth. I never thought I was perfect. I never thought I could do anything perfect, but I needed you to think I was perfect. I needed to not be caught making a mistake. And self-reliance is that I am not going to be enough. And again, that something's going to happen that's going to be, not to repeat myself, but I guess I will, T-O-O something. It's going to be too much. It's going to be too hard.
Thank you.
It's going to, you know, what if I lose this job, it won't be okay. If I was moving toward bankruptcy in 1997, I will tell you, in 1997, I did an inventory, and I did an inventory around my finances. And I did it honestly, and I looked at it, and it was clear in that inventory that I needed to make some changes, but I was unwilling to make them. I didn't go do a fifth step with that inventory. I folded it up, and I put it in the back of my big book. And in 1999, I lost my home and filed bankruptcy. But for the 2 years leading up to that, I spent a lot of time afraid that I won't be okay. And I was on an airplane one day, and I'd been waking up at 4 a.m. with a knot in my stomach, my head spinning, just afraid of what was going to happen. I can't take it if this happens. And I get on this airplane, and I realize I'm almost doubled over in my seat. Every muscle in my body is tensed up. And I had what's as close to a vital spiritual experience as I've had in AA. All of a sudden, what came over me was, sure, this can happen. Sure, this can happen, and I'll be okay. It just won't look like I think I want it to look like. And sure enough, we lost. We, you know, I often tell the story that we, we lost our home, but it was in a different state. We had moved and were renting a home, but they came to our house and they took our cars, right? And they put our two cars up on a flatbed truck, and I was standing out front watching this truck drive off with my two cars on it, and I called my sponsor, and I said, "Frank, man, they took my cars." And he went, "No, Steve," he said, "actually, they took their cars." He said, "They took the cars you quit paying for." And he said, "You'll be okay, man." And if indulge me, I'm going to take that story a bit further, and it may seem off point, but I think it's not. We went 2 weeks later. A friend of ours was in, and it was a really nice car that they took off, by the way. The car, I was not paying for a really nice car. And we went, and a guy that I knew in the program helped my wife and I get a car. It was about a 9-year-old Chevy. And we go Chevrolet Lumina. They don't make them anymore. And it was an ugly-ass green color. But we go, and he gets us this car that we shouldn't be able to get, because we didn't have the money and didn't have the credit. But we left there so grateful, and my wife was in the car. We were crying, honestly. We were so grateful that he had helped us get this car. And about 3 weeks later, I'm driving down the road, and I'm thinking, this piece of shit green Chevrolet. And all of a sudden, I had lost my gratitude, and that's what happens to me is that car didn't change, but from day to day, I would be wonderfully grateful for that car. And the next day, I would think I'm way too cool for this car. And the car never changed, but my perspective and really my relationship to God is what would change and color my experience. And today, I'm just more and more comfortable in more situations.
Thank you. Ted, you got your hand raised. Go ahead and unmute yourself.
My name's Ted, and I'm an alcoholic. Steve, thank you very much for your share. Appreciate it a lot. I was wondering about the time factor. When you work with a new guy, a brand new guy especially, do you send him out to do all – you talked about three inventories. I also do a miscellaneous inventory also. But I'll try to make them come back every week, you know, if as long as they will, of course. That's my suggestion, to come back weekly with, like, starting with a list of all the people, just a first column, basically, of all the names, and then go on from there. I was wondering, you know, how you feel about that. I know a lot of people do all the whole inventory, and sometimes it seems like they take years, to be honest about it, to, you know, long times. So that's my question. Thanks.
I typically, and right now it's funny, I'm going through the steps with on Zoom with a group of the men that I sponsor, and we're in the middle of the fourth step right now. But what I typically do, Ted, is try to get somebody to get through those first three columns. That's what we'll sit and talk about like we did here tonight. And send them off to get those three columns together, and then come back. They can call me, certainly, but we'll look at that, talk about that, then try to move to that, exact nature of my wrongs and then move on to the fear inventory and do that, and then move on to the sex inventory rather than send somebody off to do all three and then come back. That's typically, I'm not sure if that's fully answering your question, but that's kind of the approach that I usually take. Yet sometimes it can change person to person depending on how the conversation's going and if there's a particular challenge that requires a little deeper dive.
Thanks a lot. And I like the emphasis on ideals that you put on it. It's mentioned five times on those two pages, 69 and 70, and I think it's so, you know, that's where we're headed in that particular area of inventory is what is your, you know, how are you going
to
go?
It's up to you.
Your life.
I just want to know.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you, Ted. Pat, go ahead and unmute yourself.
Hi, I'm Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. Steve, I haven't gotten to the inventory yet, but when I first heard about the inventory list and all that stuff from everybody who speaks on here, it kind of freaked me out a little bit. It's like, you know, that's a whole lot of work, man. I mean, to just try and remember everything and go back in your mind. I know I can't remember everything. What am I going to do? But the more I listen to everybody who speaks about it, this is a very crucial spot within this recovery program for me. So instead of scaring me, I don't want to say I'm looking forward to it, but I know it has to be done. And I have a better mindset about this. I know it's going to be a little difficult, or it's going to be very difficult. And the way you explained it tonight was really, really cool. And I appreciate you being here, and I just want to thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Pat. And I would say, you know, sometimes I know I'm guilty of it, that we can talk about this stuff so much that I complicate something that's really quite simple. And if I really just look in the book at the directions, you know, you're a bright guy, I'm a bright guy. If I read down through there, it says do this. And if I do it, what it says, and then go and do the next thing it says, I'll be amazed how the inventory actually takes me. I don't, and I'll overcomplicate it sometimes, and I hope I didn't do that tonight. But, cause there's nothing to remember. But I hope as much as anything, when we talk about this stuff, I hope to remove the obstacles and again, talk more about where we're trying to head than get too caught up in the mechanics of what to do.
I thank you very much, man.
There's a bunch of people in the chat, Steve, that are thanking you. I don't know if you've read that yet.
Well, I don't want to miss it.